so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Stephanie Blankenberg. She's the head of the Debt Development and Finance Branch of the Division of Globalization and Development Strategies at the United Nations Commission on Trade and Development, or acronym that we're all familiar with, UNCTAD. She's been a developed economist in the UK, was a senior lecturer for many years, and has been a good friend of INET, our Commission on Global Economic Transformation, so-called CGIT. I remember in the formative period looking for her guidance as to where, how we should shape things. And she's also been involved in our Young Scholars Initiative and some schools, along with our former colleague and good friend, Ursula Constantini. Stephanie, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is a very interesting and exciting time. Everybody, in light of the pandemic and COVID-19, how would I say, reduces at some level the scope of their curiosity and focuses on the dangers near and right around them. But UNCTAD has recently released a call for a $1 trillion debt write-off for the developing world. And I'm curious, what inspired that? Why do you think it's justified? How will it be implemented and achieved?
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, we released this in April, shortly after the sort of worldwide onset of the COVID-19 crisis, to call attention alongside other measures to the really drastic measures required for the developing world, not only to get through this this pandemic, but also to, of course, recover as soon and recover as solidly as possible from it. Now, let me say briefly something on the $1 trillion debt relief. This is part of a package that we proposed based on a rough, relatively conservative estimates of the liquidity needs that would arise in the wake of this crisis in the developing world of about $2.5 trillion US dollars. As it turned out, by coincidence, that also was the estimate of the IMF at the time. Now, since this, as I said, was back in April and March, early mid-April, since then, of course, the pandemic has continued to evolve. And in retrospect, these may be relatively conservative estimates, or they certainly will be that to the extent that that the crisis continues, but also to the extent that liquidity and debt relief remains elusive for many developing countries. In addition to the $1 trillion proposed debt relief initiative for developing countries, we suggested that special drawing rights that also have been very much in the discussion in this regard were very important, and in particular, a new general allocation of special drawing rights, also tentatively around the $1 trillion threshold, though that entails a number of procedural problems, and we may come back to this at some later stage, plus at least $500 million ODA health package that should be financed from certain amounts of unfulfilled ODA commitments to developing countries in the past. So this $1 trillion debt relief proposal is part of this wider package that focuses on the need to very quickly and immediately get liquidity, bring international liquidity to developing countries, and give them fiscal breathing space to address the crisis, but also the subsequent recovery from it. Now, why $1 trillion in particular. Of course, these are ballpark figures. We're talking about 130 countries here that have very different external and total debt debt profiles. But the basic consideration is quite simple. When we look at the redemption schedules for only their public external debt in developing countries in 2020, so this year, and in 2021 next year, that is what developing countries need to repay or would have needed to repay under normal circumstances, we are looking at about 2.3 trillion for high-income developing countries and about 700 billion to about just over 1 trillion for low and middle income countries taken together. That constitutes a massive wall of maturities that these countries have to deal with. Now, again, just taking this as a broad reference point, 1 trillion suddenly doesn't sound so enormous. Of course, the situation in high-income developing countries can be very different from low- and middle-income countries, as we know. But there are also many high-income developing countries in trouble. In particular, just to give you an example, for example, many of the small island development states, that is, many of the Caribbean islands, but also African islands, Cabo Verde and others, and in other Asian, for example, regions of the developing world, are in extraordinarily severe trouble, despite being high-income countries. Now, secondly, if we want to look at what constitutes debt relief that can make a substantive contribution not only to get through the current crisis, but also to prepare the grounds for a productive, sustainable, and solid recovery. One historical indicator is the debt restructurings for the post-Second World War German economy, the famous so-called London Agreement of 1953. What happened there is that Germany's debt in its various borders since the First World War until 1993 and debt after 1945 was renegotiated by the Allies with Germany. And what was agreed, even though this was a country that had at least partially caused the First World War and certainly entirely caused the Second World War, was granted a 60% haircut of its debt, down from something which at the time amounted to something like roughly 36 billion over these two periods to 14.5 billion Deutsche Mark. Now, if this can be done in this kind of context, and of course there were all sorts of motivations behind it, and if it can be done in a way that signals very strong interest in the lasting recovery, in particular for obvious reasons with the Cold War starting in West Germany, then why can this not done in a situation such as we're facing now of a global, so far unprecedented pandemic for the developing world and of the just the redemption schedules, not the accumulated debt stocks of these countries, just the redemption schedules over the period 2021, 1 trillion amounts to about 60% of what is due over these next 2 years. So this is a fairly modest proposal seen in this context. Of course, that doesn't mean that one would have to have a closer look, especially how such debt relief should be carried out. And a lot of debate has been going forward about this in recent months. Should it be temporary standstills in particular, which is not really debt relief? That's just kicking the can down the road in the expectation that maybe 1-2 years' time from now, these countries will have recovered to a position to prior to the crisis and can just resume their accumulated debt repayments, which seems extraordinarily optimistic as of now. Now, or to what extent should it entail debt cancellation, that is haircuts, and what should these look like for different countries. This is where things, of course, become a bit more complex and will require some analysis, since, of course, when we look at developing countries, and that's the difference with the historical example from Germany, we are looking at, we're not looking at a homogeneous set of countries. So these countries have very different debt compositions. They have very different levels of debt burden. So say, for example, if we just look at an not very meaningful, but nevertheless often quoted average figure of debt to GDP ratios for developing countries as a whole, on average, those still are just below 30% of GDP, which doesn't sound too frightening when you look at this. But of course, this hides debt to GDP ratios of over 100% in some countries, nevertheless, and otherwise high, much higher debt to GDP ratios in very many developing countries, and of course very fast growing in this current crisis. But what the real issue here is that what constitutes the vulnerability of developing countries pretty much across the border and across different income categories is not so much just the volume of debt burdens as a percentage of GDP. This really is a very, very rough indicator that tells you at the end of the day very, very little, especially if taken as an average across the entire developing world. What really is at the heart of these debt vulnerabilities is the composition of debt that has been accumulated over the past 2 to 3 decades in the context of what, of course, is something which INET listeners will be entirely familiar with, the rapid financialization of the global economy. Now, for developing countries, what this has meant pretty much across income countries is that they have been pushed into international financial markets, and that means also into the hands of private creditors and private financial investors speculating with developing country debt, both private as well as sovereign debt, when really their own financial banking systems were very often not ready for this, as we would say, as economists, had relatively shallow financial and banking systems. That has meant that we're looking at a very different, even very rough and average figure still, when we're looking at the total stock of debt accumulated in developing countries over the past couple of decades, reaching in at the end of 2019 almost twice their GDP, that is 191% of GDP. That means all debt accumulated. That's external debt, domestic debt, public debt, private debt. Now that already begins to sound rather different and rather more worrying. And particularly since the global financial crisis, in the context of a continuously mushrooming, for example, shadow banking sector, as opposed to some regulatory measures for the official banking sector, we have seen private debt in developing countries really increase very, very steeply, whereas public debt has been more nuanced, more mooted under often also macroeconomic policy regimes, partly arising from the conditionalities of IFIs, but also from own policy stances in developing countries. The expansion of public debt has therefore been more muted. Now, what this translates to, first of all, these large mountains of private debt, much, much higher in high-income developing countries for obvious reasons than in certainly low-income economies and middle-income economies, pose a very large contingent liability on the public balance sheets in developing countries. Not just on public balance sheets generally, but of course also where, say, you have in larger developing economies, corporates, non-financial corporates that have followed the trend and have become debt addicted in foreign denominated currency, where they cannot hedge their liabilities with assets accordingly. That's a direct liability of countries' international reserves. But more broadly, what it means is that the profile of debt in all developing countries, not just high-income developing countries, is much higher risk, characterized by much shorter maturities, by increased rollover risks, what, as I said, we have referred to in the past as the business of debt with developing country debt. It also means, for example, that investment into that debt in the private financial sectors, international sectors, international investors, is very much driven by, for example, passive fund management strategies that rely on a relatively limited and often highly correlated number of benchmark indices, such as the, for example, the JP Morgan Next Generations Index. And what that means in turn is that the allocation financing, if you like, of financial investment to developing countries is very much driven by the factors that drive those benchmark indices. That is very broad macroeconomic and other indicators rather than country-specific factors. And it's also very much driven by global economic indicators, say, for example, of course, monetary policy decisions in advanced countries. So that will, what that means is that developing countries have been exposed to these very high-risk refinancing channels in the international financial markets with quite little, if any, control over the vulnerabilities this exposes them to. And also, of course, with very little control over continuous exogenous shocks to their economies, for example, in the context of commodity price shocks and other macroeconomic shocks to their economies. So that's the broader picture against which these debt vulnerabilities have built up. And that, of course, also affects what needs to be done now at a time when this mega shock that continues to hit developing countries is very likely to very fast build up further debt vulnerabilities on the top of already a mountain of high risk debt vulnerabilities. So this should be kept in mind. And again, that would make seem the 1 trillion much less spectacular than it might sound in the beginning. That's broadly the rationale on which this is based.
Let me interject and ask you, what I also sense from talking to people in the global South is that the tension between what you might call servicing debt and the huge new demand for health services is very, very powerful. And the other place, which is a little bit longer time frame, is a lot of people in places like India say, how can we not take care of health and poverty now in order to devote ourselves to energy transformation and climate change, which is in many ways a global public good? We need help with these things. We need multilateral support. And the urgency of the health crisis, and it does seem to me in places like India that urgency is becoming more and more apparent, makes it almost unviable to what you might call place international debt servicing above those priorities, which are about life.
Absolutely. We have a long list of countries where, say, for example, a very good indicator for this is the share of debt service repayments in of government revenues. And of course, we've had a situation prior even to this crisis where we have a long list of countries that have paid more than at least a quarter and sometimes up to 60% of their government revenues have used this to pay to service debt. That's prior to the crisis. Of course, insofar as this continues, these figures are certainly set to rise unless something is done about it. And I'll come back to that in a second. But we also have countries I've referred to them already, in particular countries that are structurally vulnerable, such as small island states that are exposed to high environmental vulnerabilities, for example, that have a long history and often are higher income developing countries that have a very long history of structural limitations on their productive growth and their capital accumulation. That are not just facing a trade-off between saying, okay, look, we just can't continue to dedicate this amount of our government revenues to debt service payments. We have a health crisis. We need to prioritize health as well as social protection expenditures. But we have countries that are in the situation that over the next 2 months, they have to decide whether they're going to continue to service debt or pay public sector salaries. So, The situation really is quite dramatic in many of these developing countries, and this doesn't always seem to sink in. Let me say a little bit of what the current multilateral initiatives are to address the issue. First of all, with a very tiny exception of the IMF offering to cancel debt repayments due since May this year to the end of this year for the 29 poorest economies. And that means we're looking at an amount of perhaps somewhere around 250 billion. It was originally often referred as 215 for a smaller number of countries. It has expanded a bit, so it's somewhere in this region. Now, that's 250 billion in actual cancellation compared to redemption schedules that I already mentioned. Over this year and the next, of around somewhere $3 trillion. Now that's all that's on the table for now in terms of actual cancellation. Now the big initiative, and I'm sure INET listeners are very well aware of this by this stage, is the G20 debt service suspension initiative that was rolled out in April. Mid-April this year. I can go a little bit into the detail of what this is about, but the main point to keep in mind is that this is about temporary standstills, moratoria, i.e. this is not debt relief. There's no debt cancellation entailed. This is simply saying, okay, we're putting debt service payments on hold for now. And once we're over the crisis, you repay what you have not paid during this period. That refers only to bilateral creditors. So this is where we get into what I mentioned previously. We get into what the actual composition of developing country debt is from the creditor side as well. So from the type of creditor, it does not include private creditors and it does not include multilateral creditors. It initially called for both to be included, but in the past roughly 6 months, there has been no progress on this. So taking it as it stands, which means it's offering suspension of debt service repayments to 73 developing countries. That is all the developing countries that are in receipt of financing from the International Development Association, IDA, and or are UN-classified least developed countries. That brings you to a group of 73 countries for a number of reasons. If all these 73 countries joined this initiative, we'd be looking at somewhere around 14 billion. Again, 14 billion compared to something like just in debt service payments due in 2020-21 in the region of 3 trillion. And in the region of just 1.1 trillion for lower and middle income countries, right? If we want to leave to one side high-income countries, even though many of these are in trouble as well. But that's not even what is actually on the table, since quite a number of eligible countries have chosen not to participate even in this initiative, either because the part of their debt that is owed to bilateral creditors is too small to be worth the hassle, or because they fear sanctioning by the international financial markets for participating in a broadly speaking, debt relief, debt service suspension payment initiative. In particular, penalization through credit rating agencies and therefore loss of access to international financial markets. So the countries for which this really is relevant is in effect a much smaller group that has either already lost access to international financial markets and or where bilateral creditors make up a substantial part of their debt. So once we are looking at all that is that has evolved around this initiative, broadly speaking, with the estimates varying a little, we may be looking between 4 to 7 billion. And that's what's on the table by the international community at the moment, nothing else. In terms of debt relief in debt temporary standstills and cancellation. Now, compared to what I've already said, this is, of course, at the very best, a drop on a hot stone, if that.
The context, it feels to me like the challenge is enormous. And we don't have what you might call the institutional systems and process to rise to the challenge. What kind of innovations in structure do you envision that we need in order to bring these things to what you might call an order of magnitude that is coherent?
Well, They are not necessarily innovations that haven't been spoken about for quite a long time, but where to some extent there's a little bit of hope that with this quite drastic situation evolving, there might be more of a willingness to consider this. And at UNCTAD, we'll be publishing this shortly. At UNCTAD, we've also worked with academic colleagues on a particular proposal to say, given all these obstacles and given the need that developing countries have for external, in the case of this crisis in particular, liquidity provision, but also external financing in terms of, in terms of developing development financing in the longer run, and the urgent need to ensure that fiscal space in these countries can more sustainably be expanded. We've worked from the debt side on a proposal to say, okay, these problems now need to be tackled in a systematic fashion. And this can only be done if we put into place a global debt deal and a global debt authority, then that can put such a deal in specific detail on the table. That means that if, as is unfortunately very likely to happen, a lot of the liquidity crisis currently unfolding in developing countries will turn into solvency crisis and default, since what is, as I said, what is on the table is appallingly little. However much even, you know, every little bit is welcome, as Winnie the Pooh would have said. Even taking this into account, there will be the need next year, and starting probably from the end of the year, to systematically address insolvency situations. Now, there are two questions related to this. What would such a global debt authority be doing? And how could it be established? And of course, trying to sort of move forward in an environment that we can see very clearly in the UN, but that's not limited to the UN. It applies just as much to other multilateral contexts from the G20 and outside debt issues, say the WTO, of course, as well, and so on. we see very little willingness in advanced countries to take the plight of developing countries seriously, which also means that, of course, normal procedures through the UN it becomes very difficult. Say we had initiatives in the UN to even promote soft law surrounding sovereign debt restructurings that where basically every developing country voted for it and every advanced country either against it or abstained. So the developing countries certainly feel that they got very short shrift on this 5 years ago. Now, what can we do now? So in this kind of context, we are thinking substantively, but also pragmatically, to say, well, such an authority should have a number of remits. It would primarily, for a starter, be a coordination and advisory institution mechanism. And what would it do? It would, first of all, provide institutional memory on sovereign debt restructurings, as well as on mechanisms that have been used and developed over the past decades in terms of facilitating debt crisis prevention, with a particular focus on developing countries. It would develop a blueprint on how automatic temporary standstills, automatic and comprehensive debt moratoria can be called in situations such as these, that is, in situations of disaster in some form, or in other situations as to be specified, either for the developing world as a whole or globally, or for specific regions. It would develop a blueprint precisely on how to begin to improve sovereign debt restructuring mechanisms, and how to develop an international institutional framework of some form to ensure that sovereign debt restructurings are not as costly, as creditor biased, and as little oriented in the long-term developmental interests, in the long-term growth prospects of developing countries, and as heavily interested in simply ensuring short-term debt repayability as at every price. It would be looking at how to develop procedures for a dispute settlement process, not unlike perhaps in the WTO, but hopefully better functioning than this. And it could, for example, also develop model laws for domestic legislation, for example, to address the activities of uncooperative private creditors, or so-called vulture funds. Now, there's a whole list of activities that could be driven forward by experts that operate independently of both debtor as well as creditor interests, to put a body of work forward, and to also act as advisory as a kind of advisory body for developing countries in trouble at their request. Now, the big question, of course, with these kind of issues is always, how could this be set up? As I've already said, ideally, of course, this would be through a multilateral treaty. But as I said, it was difficult enough to get even soft law principles off the ground in 2015 that are not binding and that were really quite broad, without infringing on say member states' national sovereignty and so on. So the chances of this are pretty low, but there are also a number of procedural mechanisms through which something like this can be set up as an autonomous institution by the interested parties and countries themselves. And the forthcoming blueprint of what a global debt authority could look like, should look like, looks at this also more closely to see how can this actually be done in a current international environment, and environment in multilateral institutions that is, I wouldn't even say, well, it is both hostile as well as indifferent to developmental interests. And that is despite the United Nations Addis Ababa Action Agenda, that from a financing of development point of view, of course, has been a very large effort, is very much heralded as a historic development agenda. But whereas we have seen since 2015, once again, the financing for this is just not coming forward. And in the context of this current crisis, it begins to stop making sense talking about Agenda 2030 without some more seriousness about tackling these fundamental problems of developing countries being hugely constrained in their own fiscal spaces. On this note, just very briefly, I'd like to add we have in a few days' time our next annual flagship report, the Trade and Development Report 2020, coming forward. And that looks in very much more detail than here is possible at the state of the global economy at present. It looks at possible scenarios under different assumptions, under different developments as they may possibly evolve, as to how the global economy might evolve further. But in this context of particular interest, it also looks at how expansive fiscal policy and fiscal strategies are not only absolutely necessary, the biggest mistake being to repeat what we already know have been massive mistakes in the past, i.e., for example, in reaction to the global financial crisis after a short while, namely to revert to austerity programs. And it shows very clearly that in advanced countries, under current conditions, it is perfectly possible to pursue and sustain long-term fiscal expansion strategies without any danger of inflationary processes taking place. But it also shows that, of course, I should add always in the on the assumption, of course, that the means put at the disposal of the economy through these policy strategies have to go to productive investment, social investment, have to go to the financing of public goods, that is, of course, also climate change adaptation and so on and so on. If that is somehow just ends up once again in financing stock market booms and asset bubbles, then obviously that would not follow. But on the assumption that such strategies in advanced countries find support, they can be financed, and they can be financed through fiscal policy in particular. In developing countries, of course, the issue is that this is much more difficult, and we all know why. In particular, at INA, there's been a long debate, of course, at the theory level about this, but the kind of financing of fiscal expansion that advanced countries, and in particular, of course, those that issue reserve currencies can do, simply does not apply to developing countries who will very quickly, if they issued domestic currency in response to crisis, would very, very quickly and have already very quickly seen themselves faced with the constraints, the structural constraints of the economies, both in the real economy, i.e. They do not have the productive apparatus to respond to this kind of strategy. They're highly import dependent. That leads to destabilization through currency depreciations. It leads to trade deficits and so on and so on. That and generally a worsening of already bad balance of payments constraints that mean that this kind of fiscal expansionary strategy is only possible if what we have discussed so far, namely if international liquidity support, including also in the form of substantive debt relief, but not only, is forthcoming. So developing countries do depend in this regard also on a helping hand from the multilateral system. And in the area of debt, what we are suggesting precisely is that it will need this kind of initiative of a systematic approach via a global debt authority to address the issues that have led us into the situation in the first place. Fine, a pandemic is a pandemic that, well, some say it was very well foreseeable, others say it wasn't, but it's here now and it was certainly not expected and is in that sense a very exceptional situation. But the strangulation of developing countries' fiscal spaces through unsustainable debt burdens and associated management and policy management of these debt burdens dates back further, and it means that we have to now, as pragmatically as possible, but also as detailed and as specific in proposal as possible, think of how institutional reform can be achieved. And our proposal for the time being will be this global debt authority, and we'll see what support we can garner for this in this wider political climate of as I said, either hostility or at the very least indifference to the plight of developing countries.
Let me return to something you said early on, which I think is very important. You talked about the constraints in emerging countries in terms of their financial system and structure. Mm. And you spoke about private debt and shadow banking, mm-hmm. some foreign exchange exposure associated with that. But you also spoke, and this reminds me, our board member, who's now, I believe, the State Commissioner of Banking and Finance in Pennsylvania, Richard Vague. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book called A Brief History of Doom. And if you said, what's the punchline? Almost every major financial crisis emanated from excesses in the private sector in the history of the world.
Yep.
And your phrase that I want to zoom in on is contingent liability. In other words, an under-supervised, an under-regulated, willy-nilly shadow banking sector raises the specter of a contingent liability that will, what you might call, overwhelm the sovereign debt channels, the sovereign financial channels in time. And I saw, looking at the United States in 2008, something emanating from the mortgage derivatives, and that collapse ended up leading to a big bulge in our federal debt. But this notion of the contingent liability, how do you contain that so that what you might call the fiscal capacity is reserved for essential development, health, and social services?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's really the key of the question, as I said, for developing countries. Of course, core elements for allowing this to go forward are not under their control and are dependent on the multilateral system and in particular advanced countries at the end of the day, through whichever exact channels, be this the IMF board or other institutional settings for this, engaging with this. Now, as regards the characterization of financial, now of course it's not just a financial crisis; it's a much bigger economic crisis. But being caused by private excesses, that's a fact. I mean, that is a fact that goes back, as far as modern capitalism goes back. But it is of course pretty hair-raising to see that after what was thought to be a seminal one in a century global financial crisis in 2008, that was primarily caused by the inability of the private sector to assess systemic risk, as opposed to shifting around individual risk. That following this, we are now in a situation where not also only global debt stocks are at record highs. They were about 150, 160 trillion in 2008, and we are now looking at 250, 260 trillion 12 years later. I mean, there's clearly not very much, if anything, been learned from this. Differently, of course, from the global financial crisis where we had this triggered in the US, as we all know, and then absorbing mostly advanced countries into the crisis trajectory at the time, whereas most developing countries were really affected through impacts channels on trade and so on, rather than through the financial and banking sector collapse itself directly. We're now looking at a situation where a very, very large part of the developing world, probably with the exception to some extent, though it has its own problems of China, has become the sort of playing ground for these kinds of speculative financial interests, with the same complete inherent inability to assess systemic risk, and that that of course can now have repercussions that we will see how this will affect advanced countries. Much talk in the land is, of course, that on the one hand, if fiscal expansion is not sustained for ideological reasons at the end of the day, or partial interests of some sort, but when where an immediate knee-jerk rejection of return to austerity is avoided, in advanced countries, we're looking at these extraordinary mountains of non-financial corporate debt, as we all know. That, on top of that, to a very large part, is of pretty terrible credit quality. So there's a little time bomb apparently waiting. And it is, of course, also clear that in the middle of this COVID-19 crisis, given the fiscal stimulus packages and so on and so on, this corporate debt keeps accumulating. So the addiction to debt and the speculation with debt in that area continues unfettered. Banking shadow sector has grown extraordinarily after the global financial crisis, and now holds more of the share of global financial assets than conventional banking sector. So it is in then a number of measures, but it's grown from what was its estimated value in 2008 of somewhere around, if I remember correctly, now 1996. $1,280 billion, so it has more than doubled in that time. So there are no mechanisms in place, and also no political willingness to coordinate policies such even across advanced countries in place to rein this in. While this continues, of course, that badly affects developing countries. And the flip side of this is, of course, that developing countries are pushed into this sphere of obscure financial transaction or high risk financial transactions, or a combination of both, because multilateral development assistance and multilateral financing programs that are affordable, perhaps based on concessional lending, plus to some extent a grant element, are simply not forthcoming and have been dwindling away in that same period. So yes, it is a, I mean, just to throw in another figure that somehow should bring it home quite clearly, is that where we are looking at something like 14 billion of debt service suspension on the table from the G20, we are looking at a global economy and a world where, at the same time, in the first 3 months of the COVID-19 crisis alone, those billionaire stockholders that own a corporate stock of countries that, in one form or the other, have benefited, so high tech, for example, as one, but also some service corporations, have made in those 3 months $500 billion. So that's half of the debt relief target that we have raised. And that, to my mind, sums up quite well what the situation is that we're looking at.
Well, that's, how would I say? That's an enormous structural challenge. And
yeah,
the at some level, I mean, I'm really thinking now of a deeper kind of ethics and philosophy, is instead of the financial markets being an unshackled master, it actually should be a tool that is in service of society. And the so-called freedom or the architectural license that the shadow banking system represents may be in very marked contradiction to what we might call a healthy or vital social design. You're sitting at a place at UNCTAD, at the United Nations, which you might call internalizes the externalities, brings the public goods to the fore. And I can only imagine that your work is quite daunting When I listen to you today, the scope and the scale of the structural challenges you've identified is overpowering.
Let me put it. Yes, I mean it is a very, very huge challenge given the structural developments in the global economy over the past three decades. I mean that applies to our area of work in terms of improving the prospects of implementing national development strategies in the global economy. But of course, it applies to every aspect of the global economy, and it applies also to the vast majority of population in advanced countries. And that's, again, something which we have seen, of course, seen in the COVID-19 crisis. It's all very well to talk about massive stimulus packages, and it's a good thing they're there, of course. But the inequality impacts of this remain yet to be seen in a context in which inequality is you know, at levels last seen in the 19th century. So, you know, there are manifold challenges. You know, there's always what is required, in my view, is a mix of recognizing the dimension of the challenge, but also decisive and belligerent realism in kicking forward, if you so like, mm-hmm. Solutions, but in order for these solutions to have a meaning in this kind of context, one has to think big, I think. That doesn't mean that you don't recognize that, as I said several times now, that the sort of political climate in the international community in multilateral negotiations is miserable from the perspective of developing countries. It means that developing countries themselves, of course, also have to pull together to push forward such solutions. I mean, one problem that also can be difficult is that, of course, when we are looking at a mass of 130 countries, we are often not necessarily looking at, quite apart from heterogeneous problems, of course, we are also looking at different governments, different priorities, and not just a sort of unified body of developing countries. But progress can be made at this level, has to be made at this level. And that's, of course, what UNCTAD was all about. UNCTAD was put into place in 1960 for precisely to organize and, if not unify, but coordinate developing countries to strengthen their voice in the international system around those issues, those challenges that they share. Now, I think, you know, in my area, as I said, we're looking at institutional reform and how this could actually be achieved and done, rather than to take home one defeat after the other by a handful of powerful and self-interested, uniquely self-interested, has to be said, advanced countries. But just on your remark about the finance as a servant. That is also something that was noted immediately after, or in this case, actually during the Second World War still, for example, at the National Executive Committee of the British Labour Party, which it has a document that is entitled Full Employment and Financial Policy Document that became very famous. But that starts off with the observation, finance must be the servant and the intelligent servant of the community and productive industry, not its stupid master. 1944. So I suppose that summarizes it, not just insofar as developing countries are very heavily affected by this, and in particular in the current situation, but as I would say ordinary working people across the globe. So that poses the usual collective action problems, but I suppose that's our role in UNCTAD with a view to development interests, but elsewhere, I'm sure also at INET, of course, political and intellectual interest in terms of achieving reforms in the international financial and monetary system that are the precondition for progress on pretty much anything else, everything else.
Well, I can say I think that you spend your life, I'm speaking now to my young scholars, you spend your life on very, very important problems. You spend your professional life doing many things that are very, how would I say, complicated, difficult, require a perseverance, a kind of, what would you call it, require a stamina. But they're very important. This is among the highest purpose. And I'm grateful that you do it.
Thank you very much. But Einet, of course, does something very similar. And we've worked together on a number of issues, which also are directed in particular to the next generation. I mean, often generations make the mistake not to think about how to pass on to next generations, which to my mind has always been a very important issue. We've seen this, for example, in some certain universities that had very strong academic community of world-leading heterodox economists, but who, in figuring out where they disagreed, forgot to ensure that their institutional survival to some extent. But we've also, to come back to UNCTAD, of course, for this reason, you know, worked with you in particular in the UNCTAD Summer School for the young scholars, which, you know, we this year it was virtual, but which we very much intend to carry forward. And HOPE is also a place to bring together both young scholars as well as younger practitioners who operate in this multilateral world of intergovernmental negotiations and leading academic experts on the very many topics that, while they are often interrelated, require this kind of well-founded theoretically clear, but also policy and action oriented analysis, so that that one can move forward on however gradual, of course, from the point of view of an individual institutional reform might be. But if that's not done, then things can only go backwards, of course.
Well, I want to thank you for, how would I say, sharing with us some of the things that are at the top of UNCTAD's concerns, foreshadowing your report, which I believe will be released on September 22nd, your trade and development report, and exploring these deeper concepts, these what you might call flaws of design or fault lines that could create havoc in the future. I know you and I have talked a little bit about the which you might call precedents that were being set by the Argentine sovereign debt restructuring recently. Mm-hmm. And seeing all of this in the context of the pandemic, where it's not about what you might call the lack of discipline of the debtor or what have you, that what we're actually seeing is something that is where what you might call the debtors did not cause the problem that exacerbated their challenges so markedly. And we need a different vision, we need a different design, and you really are quite unique. You stand right at the center of it. And I'm grateful that you spent time with us here today.
You're most welcome. And personally, I'm also very glad to be at UNCTAD, and the reason I joined precisely because there is this possibility space of interacting between the more academic and more policy oriented areas of activity in very close cooperation, very fruitful cooperation, which I think is what is required to provide at least impetus for steps forward. Just very briefly on, if I may. I don't know whether we're out of time or if I may, on the Argentine debt restructuring, since this, of course, has been very much on the forefront of some discussions. There is, of course, a broader point in some broad sense, macroeconomic mismanagement in developing countries themselves can be a source of unsustainable debt burdens. Now, certainly, insofar as the debt that was being negotiated in the Argentine crisis is concerned, that was actually the case, since under the Macri government, there was very irresponsible lending into Argentina, including by the IMF, that, in to put it in a nutshell, served pretty much directly for capital flight. That is about the most unproductive use of external debt that one can imagine. So in that sense, there is of course an issue that pertains to particular governments, and in the history of Argentina, there are a number of governments who have behaved similarly, but there have also been governments who have actually had quite reasonable economic management, nevertheless encountered unsustainable debt burdens. And that's, I think, a very important point to keep in mind, namely that in the current situation, whatever improvement, space for improvement there is, especially in smaller developing countries, for their own domestic debt management and the policies they use, at the heart, as I said in the very beginning, of these financial and debt vulnerabilities is not their lack of debt management, or the famous preoccupation of advanced countries with debt transparency, so-called one of the main slogans in these debates, because given what we've said about the international financial system, the exposure to exogenous shocks and the limitations, the structural limitations to fiscal space in developing countries, you could be as transparent as a glass bowl, and you still can be hit by a fiscal, by a financial or debt crisis. So it's certainly not a lack of a so-called data transparency that is in any way majorly responsible for the situation. That doesn't mean that improvements can't be made, and UNCTAD itself also, of course, has a very large 40-year-old technical cooperation programs with debt management offices in mostly lower-income developing countries, about 70 of those. So we are perfectly well aware of international assistance, technical assistance to help developing countries, in particular poorer developing countries, with this. But the idea that this is a problem of data and transparency for most developing countries is inappropriate. And in the case whereas actually the Macri government in Argentina certainly is an example of entirely irresponsible debt management. The restructuring from the apart all sorts of technical details, but the restructuring from the wider perspective of developing countries in Argentina is of particular interest, I think, because of the strategy adopted by the current government that put into place very clear arguments about why and how debt repayments would be sustainable over time. That is, over the longer trajectory, 10-year trajectory and beyond, by looking at what it would consider to be sustainable growth, what it would be consider sustainable fiscal balances and sustainable trade balances, of course, very important in developing countries as well. And sustainable here meant allowing for growth recovery, but also allowing for at least basic social protection and social justice and avoidance of political instability being an inherent part of this proposal. That's what makes that so important beyond the particular case of Argentina itself, and it's of course very high exposure to private creditors. And it had the good fortune that the IMF accepted certainly the principles, but a lot of the detail of this very competent analysis put forward by the government. Well, I mean, not least also because it didn't cover itself with glory in providing this largest loan in its history to a government that did not meet the criteria, the IMF's own criteria for such a loan, and subsequently managed it extraordinarily badly. So there's a consolation, of course, of very, very difficult negotiations that in the end worked out, broadly speaking. But that, of course, that kind of negotiation dynamic is not something that is necessarily open to many smaller developing economies in particular, which is another reason why this global debt authority is so important, because it can be a space, an institutional space, around which developing countries can also communicate and coordinate their own strategies.
That was very, how would I say, I enjoyed, because many of the things that we've talked about over the course of this hour all of a sudden zoomed in a particular context, and which you might say illustrated, the case study illustrated the principles very nicely.
Thanks.
So anyway, I think we should bring things to a close here, but Stephanie, thank you very much. I look forward to planning a webinar with you so that young scholars can go through the trade and development report and then, take a deep dive with your guidance. But for right now, I'm sure I'll ask you to come back in the not too distant future. But for right now, I just want to say thanks. Thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you very much for having me here today. And for very interesting questions and a very inspiring discussion here. So we certainly from our end, not just myself, but also my colleagues in our division, very much look forward to continued cooperation with INET, with the young scholars, whether in regard to the trade and development report next week, but in terms of all these very challenging, but also very, very how can I put it, inspiring challenges that we face and that we, where we share this kind of decisiveness to confront them.
Oh.
So thank you very much.
And our enthusiasm at INET for working with UNCTAD is, how do I say, maybe more than mutual.
Okay, no, I'm sure it's entirely mutual.
Very good. Talk to you again soon.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.